You're listening to Charlottesville's Podcasting Network at SevillePodcast.com. Lectures, radio shows, and more are available on demand at SevillePodcast.com. Don't miss another exciting podcast. Sign up for our email alerts today. I'm Dan Gould. Terry Cooper, owner of Terry Cooper Political Research, addressed many of the hot-button issues dominating politics today. Mr. Cooper spoke at the Wednesday, June 13, 2012 meeting of the Senior Statesmen of Virginia. The meeting was held at the Charlottesville Senior Center. Following the presentation, questions were taken from the audience. The program was moderated by SSV Vice President Bob McGrath.
It's my pleasure today to introduce our speaker, Terry Cooper. Terry does political research, principally opposition research for Republican candidates. Now, he's a graduate. Let's see how he came by this job. He's a graduate of Episcopal High School, Princeton University, and the University of Virginia Law School. He practiced law with the Wall Street firm Sullivan & Cromwell and held executive positions with three Fortune 500 companies before founding his firm, Terry Cooper Political Research, in 1982, and it's now based here in Charlottesville. Terry has taught opposition research at the Republican National Committee's Campaign Management Colleges, at American University's Campaign Management Institute, at George Washington University's Graduate School of Political Management, at the University of Florida, and at training programs sponsored by the state Republican parties of Virginia, Delaware, Illinois, Michigan, Tennessee, Wisconsin, and Washington. As a political consultant, his clients have included then-Speaker of the U.S. House, Newt Gingrich, and eight other Republican members of the House, Bob McDonald when he was Attorney General, and a number of members of the Virginia and Florida legislators. You all know the expression, inside baseball. Terry has been political consultant for 30 years and in all 50 states, and I think we're going to be treated today to inside politics. The title of his talk is Why Good People Don't Run for Office and Other Perplexing Questions About Politics Today. I think he means why many good people don't run, but in any event. Per usual, after Terry's talk, we'll have plenty of time for Q&A. I'll be the moderator, and we'll go around with microphones to get your to get you to speak into the microphone to ask the questions. Anyway, let's welcome Terry Cooper.
Thank you, Bob. Good afternoon. Thank you very much for coming. Today I want to talk about three topics, and the first is why more good people don't run for elective office. This subject has been getting a lot of attention recently because there's been widespread discontent, particularly among Republicans and independents, with the quality of the Republican presidential candidates. A couple of weeks ago, Scott Rasmussen, a pollster, asked 1,000 likely voters this question: are Barack Obama and Mitt Romney the best two people to be running for president? Only 19% said yes, and I got to tell you, I don't know any of that 19%. 64% said no. There's been a lot of criticism of these candidates, and some of it has been quite funny, even to a Republican political consultant like me. This is political analyst Stu Rothenberg. Almost everyone seems unhappy with remaining GOP candidates except their immediate families. Satirist Andy Borowitz. A growing number of conspiracy theorists believe that the Republican candidates who keep showing up for televised debates are imposters, and that the actual GOP candidates are tied up in a warehouse somewhere. When the most sensible person on stage is Ron Paul, you know that what you're witnessing is an elaborate hoax. Then there's this wonderful cartoon. Look at the starter. Then there was this email that went viral. The inability to become aroused over any of the choices for president put forward by either party in the 2012 election year is electile dysfunction. And there were some hilarious comments about individual presidential candidates. Here's satirist Andy Borowitz on Newt Gingrich. Former House Speaker Newt Gingrich has plunged in the polls as voters have begun to remember who he is. The Gingrich campaign has begun seeking the support of people with mental disorders and other memory issues that make it hard for them to retain basic information. The problem is most of those people are currently running for president. And here's GOP consultant Mike Murphy talking about Rick Perry. Listening to Rick Perry talking policy is like watching a chimp trying to open a locked suitcase. And here's Rick Perry on Mitt Romney. I keep waiting for him to say, pardon me, would you have any gray poupon? Now, we can laugh and we can gripe, but our elected officials have positive jobs because they make the policies that govern us. We all want really good people in those jobs, and we do have some. But why don't we have more? Why isn't every election a competition among the best? Let's explore why more good people don't run for public office. Let me give you an analogy. Let's suppose you're a freshman at the University of Virginia, and you're a high achiever, and you're bright, and you're very highly respected, and you're very popular. And you have bids from every fraternity on the grounds. And there's this one fraternity that is hated by everybody except its members. And even among the members, there are factions that are constantly bickering with each other. They are a bunch of people who are simultaneously low performers and arrogant. And every few years, some of them get carted off to jail. Now, are you going to join that fraternity? Other reasons. In almost all campaigns above the local level, there comes a point when you have to campaign full time, which means that if you have a day job other than an elected office, your income stops. So that means immediately that a whole swath of people is knocked out of the ability to run for office. In addition, you may miss out on opportunities. If a headhunter calls while you're campaigning and says, gee, we've got this wonderful job, are you going to say, well, I'm going to abandon my campaign to interview for it? Furthermore, you may have to take out a second mortgage or otherwise go deep into debt to fund your campaign. Also, campaigning can be a huge strain on your marriage or other personal relationships. And you have to forego fun things like vacations and other family time. Forget about going to the kids' soccer games. You have to eat lousy, unhealthy food and seldom have time to exercise. You have to spend a lot of time with fringe people and importuners who are trying constantly to get you to buy in to their particular cause. Let me tell you a story about an importuner that I had some years back in 1989 when I was working in the gubernatorial campaign in Virginia for Stan Parris. The Parris campaign had a policy that if somebody called them up with information about an opponent, They would tell the caller, well, our researcher, Terry Cooper, will get back to you, so give me your name and phone number. So I got this call. You need to call X person. He has information about one of our primary opponents. So I called him up, and he had all this detailed information about the primary opponent. And he was really accurate. We checked it out. Everything checked out. And it was very useful information. Then when he finishes giving me the information, he says, now I need to change subjects on you. I said, okay. I mean, he'd been really good so far. So he said, did you know that Queen Elizabeth is an important player in an international drug conspiracy? And you work as hard in a campaign as you have ever worked. It is not unusual for an early morning breakfast meeting or greeting voters at a plant gate as the shift changes at 7 a.m., then back for fundraising calls, then a lunch to raise money, then more fundraising calls, meetings at diners to greet people, etc. And you may not get home until 11 or later at night, and another day of the same will be tomorrow, and the next day, and the next day, and the next day. And there's some really unpleasant aspects of campaigning, at least unpleasant to most people. You have to ask, and spend a lot of time asking, perfect strangers for large amounts of money. I don't know many people who enjoy doing that. Disappointments abound. Some of your events are heartbreakingly poorly attended. Your good friends of many years take the side of your opponent, and your good friends can criticize your campaign, its tactics, and its positions. It seems like everybody's a critic, and you feel very lonely. You'll be pressured to abide by the constituent group's issue agendas of your political party. Opposition research is going to be done on you. It might include ancient history, like Mitt Romney's high school alleged bullying experience, or a 20-year-old DUI for George W. Bush. Exaggerations, items taken out of context, items involving family members, your finances, your effective tax rate, who you make charitable contributions to, or how much, or if any, etc. Nevertheless, some good people do run. And we should actively encourage them to run and should actively support them when they do. If there's an opening and you know of somebody who would be a good candidate, don't wait for them to announce. Go speak to them. And there are things you can do after they've gotten in the race to help. For example, the spouse of a candidate is in one of the worst jobs imaginable and is very lonely typically. Invite that spouse over to dinner. Help with chores the candidate can't do. The candidate can't go to the kids' soccer games, but you can, and cheer them on and take them out to the Baskin and Robbins afterward. And you can volunteer as well. Now let's turn to the second topic, the Tea Party movement. Who are those folks, and is the energy of the movement spent? Now, contrary to what a lot of people think, the Tea Party movement did not begin as a reaction to Barack Obama. It began under President George W. Bush as a reaction to him, and in particular to out-of-control spending, and to the Troubled Asset Relief Program, which was the bailout of the banks. And it's the latter that really got people angry. Politicians always say that people should work hard and play by the rules. And TARP was regarded as an instance of people who didn't play by the rules getting bailed out. And that just angered an awful lot of people. But once Obama got into office, the anger increased because they saw more out-of-control spending, particularly the stimulus. Actions that were perceived as arbitrary or as being due to cronyism. The auto bailout being a really good example of that, where the UAW, the Auto Workers Union, got especially favorable treatment, but the bondholders, who were secured creditors, got shafted. Then there were actions perceived as outright unconstitutional. Notably, the individual mandate in the Affordable Health Care Bill, and also a part of that bill, the directive that Catholic organizations would have to provide contraceptives. And again, failing to punish the bad actors who brought the financial crisis upon us. The people who took out the liar's loan mortgages, the mortgage brokers who wrote them up, the people who securitized them into derivatives, the credit rating agencies who said those derivatives are AAA, and the brokers who sold the derivatives to the public. None of them have gone to jail. And there is a real anger that they haven't. Now, in these respects, the Tea Party people resemble, in many respects, libertarians. Now, what binds them together? I think three things. Again, libertarian. Number one, they are fiscal conservatives. Number two, they are constitutional conservatives. They feel that the federal government should do only those things that the Constitution expressly or by necessarily implication says they're allowed to do. And they are dedicated to private property rights. In other respects, this is a very diverse movement. Some are Social Security conservatives, others aren't. A recent poll was taken of Tea Party people only. And they said, do you identify more as a Tea Party member or as a Republican? And about half said Tea Party and half said Republican. In general, I would say they're a very loose confederation of very independent-minded people. Now, has their energy been spent? I don't believe so. I think the energy's there, but the tactics have changed. They've become a lot less confrontational. They operate more according to thought-through plans. Their focus has been broadened to include state and local governments as well as the federal government. And they're very heavily educational. The local Tea Party, for example, every meeting that I know of has had a guest speaker. They have hosted debates and candidate forums at the federal level and at the local level and at the state level. So you might say the movement has matured. Now, topic three. The Citizens United decision of the Supreme Court and super PACs. Here's my summary of this. Citizens United is not an aberrational decision. It followed Supreme Court precedent. Number two, the fear of heavy corporate involvement in politics is wildly overblown. Number three, there's a proposed constitutional amendment to deny all constitutional protection to corporations, and I think that is dreadful public policy. But that does not mean at all that every contribution to a super PAC or to a related nonprofit is legitimate. Legislation to tighten up the rules on what is and is not coordination between a campaign and a supposedly independent super PAC is badly needed. And what's more, there is a disclosure problem regarding the nonprofits, and that problem needs to be remedied by legislation. Now, the issue in Citizens United was whether corporations have free speech rights under the First Amendment. So let's look at the First Amendment. I wish we had a separate bulletin board we could put this up. Congress shall make no law, I've left out the religion part of it, abridging the freedom of speech or of the press, or the right of the people peaceably to assemble, or to petition the government for a redress of grievances. Now, the leading case on the scope of First Amendment protections of campaign dollars is a 1976 case, Buckley versus Vallejo, that involved the post-Watergate campaign finance reforms. That law had two prohibitions that were relevant to us today. Number one, it limited individual contributions to a federal campaign to $1,000 per campaign per election. And number two, it prohibited individual independent expenditures of more than $1,000 per year per individual total. Now, let's talk about for a second, what is an independent expenditure? It's an election-related activity undertaken that is independent of the campaign that it likes. And also, if it's an opposition independent expenditure, it's independent of the opponent of the candidate it dislikes. A very common example of independent expenditures is when the National Rifle Association sends its members bumper stickers reading "Sportsman for X." Now, note that in both cases, what we were talking about, what the statute prohibited, was individual activity, individual contributions, individual independent expenditures. But you'll see that there were at least four cases in which the Supreme Court, in its decision, lumped together individuals and groups. It ruled that the law's limitation on individual independent expenditures violated the First Amendment. Now, this was not a 5-4 ruling. Eight judges participated. Justice Stevens did not. I can't for the life of me tell what Blackmun's position was, but the other seven were all in agreement, liberals and conservatives. And they said, there's practically universal agreement that a major purpose of the First Amendment was to protect the free discussion of governmental affairs, of course including discussions of candidates. They added that a restriction on the amount of money a person or group, and note, or group, can spend on political communication during a campaign necessarily reduces the quantity of expression by restricting the number of issues discussed, the depth of their exploration, and the size of the audience reached. That's because virtually every means of communicating ideas requires the expenditure of money. In fact, the court went out of its way to talk about the importance of group activity in politics. It said that the constitutional right of association involved in an NAACP case stemmed from the court's recognition that effective advocacy of both public and private points of view, particularly controversial ones, is undeniably enhanced by group association. Now, while ruling that the prohibition against independent expenditures greater than 1,000 was unconstitutional, the court upheld the law's limitation of campaign contributions to $1,000 per candidate per year. And it said, by contrast with a limitation on expenditures for political expression, a limitation upon the amount that any one person or group may contribute to a candidate or political committee entails only a marginal restriction upon the contributor's ability to engage in free communication. A contribution serves as a general expression of support for the candidate and his views, but does not communicate the underlying basis for the support. Now, some people had argued that the low limit on independent expenditures was justified by the need to keep people with superior resources from dominating political debates, and the court very summarily rejected that position. Whoops. Okay. It is argued, the court wrote, that the ancillary government interest in equalizing the relative ability of individuals and groups to influence the outcome of elections serves to justify the limitation on express advocacy of the election or defeat of candidates imposed by the law's expenditure ceiling. But the concept that government may restrict the speech of some elements of our society in order to enhance the relative voice of others is wholly foreign to the First Amendment. And like I say, this was a 7-0 or 8-0 opinion. Now let's turn to Citizens United. Now here are the key facts. Citizens United was a nonprofit corporation. The head of it was a fellow named David Bossie, who was rabidly anti-Clinton. He had made a career out of investigating Bill and Hillary Clinton. He is allegedly the one who convinced Congressman Dan Burton, who chaired at the time the House Government Reform and Oversight Committee, that White House counsel Vince Foster's death was a murder instigated by Bill. In 2008, Citizens United released a film called Hillary the Movie, the gist of which that she was unfit for office and voters should vote against her. Citizens United proposed to spend $1.2 million from its corporate treasury to make that movie available through video on demand and to pay additional sums for advertisements promoting it. Now, federal law at the time prohibited corporations from making any independent expenditures at all. So Citizens United sued the Federal Election Commission for a declaratory judgment saying that that prohibition on corporate independent expenditures violated the free speech portion of the First Amendment. And the Supreme Court, in a 5-4 decision, ruled that it did violate the First Amendment. And it said very straightforwardly, the court has recognized that First Amendment protections extend to corporations. And the government cannot restrict political speech based on the speaker's corporate identity. But as I said earlier, that doesn't mean that every corporate dollar, or even in every individual dollar, spent on political activity is lawful. The critical question continues to be the question framed by the Buckley versus Valeo decision. Is the money we're talking about more like a campaign contribution, or is it more like an independent expenditure? If it's like an independent expenditure, it can't be restricted. On the other hand, if it's more like a campaign contribution, it can be limited and conceivably even prohibited altogether. So let's turn to the distinctions between a contribution and an independent expenditure. In the case of contributions, the contributor writes a check, sends it into the campaign, and the campaign decides how the money's going to be spent. Now, the money may be spent on a message. It may be spent on an administrative function like paying staff salaries. The important consideration is the contributor has no control over how it's spent. That's a decision by the campaign. Let's contrast that with the independent expenditure. The classic independent expenditure involved this fellow, former Illinois Republican Senator Chuck Percy. From 1981 through 1984, Senator Percy chaired the Senate Foreign Relations Committee. And his views on the Middle East angered a number of people in the American Jewish community. For example, his position that then PLO had Yasser Arafat was a, quote, moderate with whom the Israelis could negotiate. This so angered a fellow named Michael Goland, who was a California OBGYN, that Goland spent $1.2 million of his own money putting up billboards and running radio ads in Illinois urging that Percy be defeated. And he was defeated. Now, in that case, Goland controlled how every penny of that money was spent. And the vast majority of that money was spent on messages that Goland chose or at least approved. So let's suppose that I, out of my vast fortune, write a check for $1 million to a super PAC. To me, whether that is legal or not depend on answers to questions like these. And what astonishes me is that the people who are railing about the Citizens United decision haven't even raised these questions. Do I even know what candidates the PAC is supporting? Now, if it's a single candidate PAC, like, let's say, Restore Our Future is for Mitt Romney, then obviously I do know. But if it is a PAC like House Majority PAC, which is a Democratic super PAC involved in all potentially U.S. House races nationwide, 435 of them, then they don't even know who they're supporting at this point, and I certainly don't. Do I agree with the messages that this PAC is spreading? And do I have any input into who the candidates are that the PAC is supporting and what their messages are. Now, if the answers to all these questions are no, it seems to me that my $1 million is like a campaign contribution. On the other hand, if the super PAC seeks input from every contributor and allows every contributor to direct his or her money to this candidate or that, or to this message or that, then it does begin to look more like an independent expenditure. But I believe that that sort of analysis has to be made. Now, there are other issues involving super PACs as well. One of them is coordination. Remember, we're talking independent expenditures. The law's language is that there can be no, quote, coordination between the favored campaign and the super PAC. Now, the FEC, Federal Election Commission, which enforces these campaign finance laws, has been unable to come up with good rules on what constitutes coordination and what doesn't. And one of the reasons is that this organization was set up to fail. It is six people, an even number, and by law, three must be Republicans and three Democrats. There is no provision for a tiebreaker. So guess what happens? On everything controversial, they deadlock and nothing gets done. Currently, the super PAC and the campaign can have the same political consultants. Now, that to me is an absolute travesty. They can share their research. Right now, the Democratic Congressional Campaign Committee, the party committee that's responsible for electing and re-electing Democrats to the U.S. House, has posted its opposition research on Republicans on its website, making it very easy for any super PAC that's interested to go to the website and coordinate its message with what the DCCC's message is going to be and what the campaign's message is going to be. The only thing that under current regulations the campaign cannot do is tell the super PAC what the content of the message should be or what the buy should be in either amount or location. Now, that's just plainly insufficient. There's also a disclosure issue. Now, I have to step back here and tell you that there are two types of groups that were spawned by Citizens United. The first is the super PAC. This is the best known. Now, it can advocate expressly for the election or defeat of a particular candidate. It can communicate 365 days of the year. But it must disclose very expeditiously. If it is doing an expenditure of $10,000 or more, it must disclose that to the FEC, who then posts it on its website, within 48 hours. And it must disclose the identity of its contributors of $1,000 or more within 24 hours. And for other cases, within 24 hours in the period immediately running up to the election. And all contributors of $200 or more, semi-annually in the non-election year and quarterly in the election year. Now, the other type of group that's spawned by Citizens United are nonprofits, so-called issue advocacy groups. These people cannot advocate expressly the election or defeat. So what do they say? call John Smith and tell him to oppose reducing doctors' fees for Medicaid. They can't communicate within 60 days of a primary or 30 days of a general. And their disclosure requirements are very, very weak. They don't have to disclose until mid-year of the following year. Now, that disclosure problem is significant, and it can be remedied by legislation. Now, there are other issues involving super PACs. One that political consultants constantly talk about is the threat of a rogue super PAC. For example, injecting issues that everybody wants to avoid, or changing the pace of the campaign. Campaigns typically operate in three stages. In stage one, your message is, "Hi, I'm a great guy. I've accomplished a lot. B, the opponent stinks. C, I'm a great guy, vote for me." Now, the super PAC can override that message. It can open up by saying that other person is an SOB and never get off it and drown out the message of the campaign. But there are a lot of non-issues, I believe, that are related to super PACs also. Number one, big corporations are simply not going to buy elections. I'm aware of only one corporation that has its own super PAC, and it's a tiny little company named Credo that is a liberal wireless telephone company in San Francisco. Through March 31, a study that was done recently showed that publicly held companies accounted for less than 1% of total contributions to the eight leading super PACs supporting Republican presidential campaigns. And none of the Fortune 500 companies had contributed one red cent. Also, you have to deal with the fact that large corporations, particularly those that sell their products under very well-known brand names to consumers, do not want to get involved in controversial issues. We've seen a couple of examples of this. In 2010, Target, the discount retailer, headquartered in Minnesota, gave, I think, $1,000 to the Republican gubernatorial candidate there based on his position on a controversial tax issue. Well, the Republican candidate was also opposed to gay marriage. And when some gay groups found out about this, they started a boycott against Target. Target immediately backed off. Then more recently, in the Trayvon Martin shooting in Florida, that brought a lot of attention to the Stand Your Ground laws and to the group American Legislative Exchange Council, also known as ALEC, that has been promoting these laws. And boycotts were launched through social media against companies like Coke and Pepsi that had contributed to ALEC, and they immediately said, "We're never going to contribute to ALEC again." So we don't have to worry about consumer companies trying to buy elections. Furthermore, I don't believe that you're ever going to have super PACs buying a high-profile election, because I think all a campaign needs to do is have enough money to get its message across. The fact that somebody else has much superior resources doesn't get them anything, as far as I'm concerned. Above the amount of money necessary to get your message across, it's wasted. You can lose an election for not having enough money to get your message across, but you can't win an election by having an overflow of money. And let me give you a couple of examples of that. Back in 1980, there was a U.S. Senate race in South Dakota between former presidential candidate George McGovern and Congressman Jim Abner. That cycle, McGovern raised $3.2 million, which at the time was just mind-blowing for South Dakota. He had so much money that he was literally buying prime-time TV, 30 minutes, not 30 seconds, 30 minutes statewide. Abner raised half that. Abner beat him by 58-39. More recently, in 2010, in the gubernatorial race in California, Meg Whitman, the Republican candidate, former eBay chairman, spent $159 million, the modern record, much of it her own money. Jerry Brown, the Democrat, spent about a quarter of that. Guess what happened? Brown 54%, Whitman 41%. Now, there's currently in Congress a proposal, House Joint Resolution 90, to overturn Citizens United. And it would read that the rights protected by the Constitution are the rights of natural persons and do not extend to for-profit corporations, limited liability companies, or other private entities established for business purposes. Note that it's not just freedom of speech that would be denied under this legislation to corporations. No free press rights. And every newspaper that I know is published by a corporation. No freedom of association rights. No right to petition for the redress of grievances. No right to due process of law. And if those rights shouldn't apply to corporations, how about other artificial amalgams of people like the NAACP, the AFL-CIO, or the Piedmont Environmental Council? I think that's dreadful public policy. I really think that that is a crazy constitutional amendment. Now, we began with some lighthearted material, and I'd like to end with some too. There are over 500 super PACs right now, and some of them have hilarious titles, and these are the ones that I like the best. Raptors for Jesus. I do not understand that. A raptor, you know, is a bird of prey. Talking smack pack. I ride inside the Pets Against Romney Committee, based on, you know, some years back, Romney had a dog, Seamus, and they went on a long trip, and they put Seamus in the doghouse and strapped the doghouse to the top of the car. And then finally, just drink the Kool-Aid. Now it's time for your questions.
Terry, my understanding was that the max that someone could give to a campaign was $2,700. You used a $1,000 figure. Which is correct?
Back at the time of Buckley versus Vallejo in 1976, it was $1,000. It's now been amended, and the most recent amendment indexes it for inflation, and that's why I forget whether it's 25 or 27 now, but it goes up every year.
I take serious issue with your statement that the involvement of corporations in politics is seriously overblown. I think our tax code and thousands of laws that benefit particular corporations is just obvious evidence to the contrary. I also take issue with the idea that you want to attribute personhood to a corporation, which is a legal entity created for financial purposes, for profit. The protections of the Constitution extend to every one of the individuals in those corporations. It's the corporation as an entity and those corporate funds that are being diverted to influence overwhelmingly our political process, so that you're not depriving any individual of their protections. You're simply saying that for-profit businesses should not be using business funds to buy an election. Now, they don't have to do it directly. The Chamber of Commerce is spending an enormous amount of money, and individuals with extraordinary, like the Koch brothers, corporate connections are spending a huge amount of money. It'll be up to $1 billion. This brings to mind the first question that you had. Why do ordinary people, good people, not run for office? Everything that you said has dealt with campaigning, and nothing that you said had dealt with governance. This is an argument for public financing and get all of that other money out of it and allow the discussion of ideas.
Well, number one, with respect to your point about corporate involvement in politics, all I was talking about was corporate involvement in the elections. Number two, you also raised the point about personhood and corporations not being people. My point is simply that the Supreme Court says that the Constitution gives these rights to groups and corporations as well as individuals. Now, one other point with respect to taxpayer financing, also known as public financing of campaigns, it's also known as welfare for politicians. And I think you don't get money out of the system that way or any other way. Money's going to be in the system. It's a question of what money. And in that case, it is money shanghaied from the taxpayers against their will, and you're in Mr. Jefferson's country now. And Jefferson said that it is awful to take taxpayers' money and use it for causes they don't like.
Terry, your second topic was very searching and very cogent. But my question relates to the first topic. And it's by analogy. And I think it's very topical and concerns all of us here. I don't think it's too far off base, because it relates to a public institution which has obvious political connections. And it's this. What do you think the dampening effect may be of the rather misty, the rather foggy machinations behind the removal of the president of UVA from office, you know, may have on efforts to replace her?
Van, interestingly, that's the third time today I've been asked about that. I have no expertise on that at all. I don't know the first thing about it.
So, Terry, let's come back to your first topic, it was the overarching topic, but why many good people don't choose to run. And I've been sort of pondering lately with the super polarization of things, essentially dysfunction in many parts of government, so forth and so on. Seems to me, particularly in the Republican side, let's talk about presidential politics. the winning candidates have to go so far in one direction, in pledges, in whatever, to gain the nomination, to win the primaries. I keep wondering whether the country wouldn't be better off if the history had been that we didn't right now have two parties, but we had a number like three parties. Probably not infinitely many parties, that would be bad, but just more than two. What do you think that would do to the whole tenor of politics these days?
Let me make two points, Bob. First, you are absolutely right that the primary process paints Republicans into right-wing corners and Democrats into left-wing corners, unless they're pretty darn malleable. One of the great things that I'm seeing now that I'm just so happy about, there's a fellow named Grover Norquist at Americans for Tax Reform who has this no tax increase pledge. More and more Republicans are saying, the hell with you, Grover. And I just love it. The second thing, Bob, I wouldn't mind seeing a third party at all. But, you know, the rules are written by the incumbents who are members of one party or the other. So if we want to do that, what you have to do is go through initiative or referendum. And that is difficult. And there are a number of states like Virginia who don't even permit such a thing. In fact, I don't think any of the original 13 colonies do. But that's the way you got to go, because you are not going to get a Republican or a Democrat to ease the way for a third party. Every reform that I'm aware of, from the nonpartisan redistricting commissions in Iowa and Arizona and California, et cetera, has been the result of popular action.
I would just like to say I have run in local elections twice, won one, lost one, and it is fun, it is enjoyable. You'd be amazed how many wonderful people you meet door to door on both sides of the aisle. Really, really well worth it. My question is, in education, what do you see as good, what do you see as bad in terms of encouraging our young people, especially in the high schools, to get involved in politics and elections?
One of the things that I think helps a lot is to introduce young people to the process and to the people involved. I think when ordinary citizens can meet candidates firsthand and talk with them and have a real conversation, that helps a lot. And the more that you can get young people volunteering, interning, et cetera, it really helps. If you look at the number of members of Congress who started as pages or interns, it is just amazing.
This isn't my question at all, but as an aside, Dana Milbeck's column in the Washington Post this morning called Grover Norquist the Grand Inquisitor, borrowing a phrase from the Middle Ages of tax policy. Anyway, my brother-in-law got a PhD from a European university in which he addressed the issue of campaigning versus governing. And his basic point, and he's not here to defend himself, was that campaigning should occupy a short duration and the curtain should come down and governance should proceed. We do not do that in the United States of America. I'm already, and I love politics. I do. It's fascinating. But I'm so tired of this campaign already. I know who I'm going to vote for. I knew a year ago. Most people do. Bring it down. I love government. Government does wonderful things for us. Let's govern. And what can we do to decrease campaign duration and money, but mostly the duration right now. I'm not even talking about the money. And focus on giving good government to the people. Big question.
Okay. If you think you're tired now, wait till October. Virginia, it looks, is going to be the epicenter of the presidential campaign, and we'll also have one of the key Senate campaigns. Most people are going to have very strong thumbs from using their remote to switch channels. In terms of shortening the campaigns, this is primarily due to the political party organizations, the RNC and the DNC. And every cycle, they try to shorten them. But then some state like Florida says, well, we want to go earlier because we're a big state. We will attract all these people coming in. We will make all sorts of money. So it just gets stymied. I can't help you.
My concern is based really on something that Reagan said years ago, and that is that government is not the answer. Government is the enemy. Government is the problem. And this concerns me when I see that one on the political side here is concerned to try and make government fail, not to look to government for solutions, but to, and so that relates to the last question, and also to the problem of the Tea Party, which I see is an extreme in that direction. That they don't want government to do anything. They feel that government has no role in society, and how they can even put forward people to support the candidates, to send them therefore to make the system fail. How can this country survive if we've got half of the population just wanting the failure of government and not to have government to work for the welfare of the country?
There's a definition for people who want government to fail, and it's anarchists. I do not regard the Tea Party people as anarchists. I think, and I think you're referring to Republicans generally, that what they want is for government to limit its functions to those that government is essential in performing, and perform them well and efficiently.
The first part of my question was partially answered, namely, how could we reduce our election process from a two-year media circus to a shorter period of time, like a quarter of a year or something? The second part is, wouldn't it be more cost-effective and much less expensive if each credible candidate is given a certain amount of money by our government to use as they please to present their case, rather than make it dependent on how many people you will be indebted for because of the size of their contributions towards your election, your intentions of assuming the presidency or any other public office?
Well, we tried that for presidential candidates. We have partial public campaign financing for presidential candidates with the check off on your income tax return. And the first year they did it, about 30% of the people checked off. It's gone down ever since. The Federal Election Commission some years back got worried about this. They saw that if the trend continued, they weren't going to have enough money to meet their commitments to the presidential candidates. So they commissioned a poll asking people, did they check off, and if not, why not? And they explained what the money could be used for. And when people heard that this money could be used for negative campaign ads and for the balloons at the party conventions, they went berserk. And they said, we do not want our tax dollars being spent for this at all. And you'll notice that today, none of the significant presidential candidates even volunteer for public campaign financing. So it was tried and it failed.
You were, in your second item, talking about Tea Party attitudes and demography, and in your first item, talking about candidates, and in your third item, we raised contributions, and it occurs to me to ask you, could you compare the current Tea Party to Ross Perot's movement 20 years ago? It seems to me there's some similarities. It's also, I think, true that Ross Perot self-financed a large part of the campaign. But it's also true that it was the most successful third-party movement in the second half of the 20th century. It was remarkably successful. I see some relationship of attitudes in the Ross Perot Consortium of Citizens to the Tea Party group. I see some differences, too. But I was curious about your analysis of that comparison and contrast.
I agree with you 100%. I think that there's a huge overlap between Perot and the Tea Party movement on fiscally conservative issues.
You mentioned opposition research that you were involved in. There are two types of research in campaigns. One, to find out everything you can negative about your opponent, and the other, to find out everything negative about your own candidate. So can you give us some examples of both?
I've never had a perfect candidate. I wouldn't know about a perfect one. I've got a candidate right now who we're going to have to deal with the fact that she has missed a whole lot of votes when she ran for president recently. And we're going to have to deal with the fact that a lot of people thought that when she was running for president, she was showing a lack of appropriate interest in the people of her congressional district. In terms of, you want an example of something I've found about an opponent? Well, I'll go back some time. I'm researching the guy again now. He's running for governor in Washington State. But some years back, he was running for re-election to the House. And this was from a very agricultural district in Washington State, where you get the Washington apples and the Washington wine. And he made it a big point that he'd gotten assigned to the House Agriculture Committee. He'd be able to do all sorts of wonderful things for his district. And we pointed out, well, why didn't you go to 70% of the meetings? Well, to me, the talisman is, does it relate to the candidate's qualifications for or performance in the office in question? If it doesn't, I say it's out of bounds.
Well, as a follow-up to that, when you do research on to find out something about the opponent and you come up with negative things, I assume that translates into negative advertisements or whatever. How effective are those? Is that how effective is negative campaigning really?
Okay. Well, first there's an intermediate step between when you find it out and when you run the ad. You do a poll and maybe a focus group as well, and you say you ask them, the voters, knowing this about the opponent, would that make you more likely or less likely to support them for election? In addition to that, I would add that any campaign that tries to be strictly negative is going to lose. In 2002, I was involved in the governor's race in South Dakota, and we had a three-way primary. My guy, who was the sitting attorney general, a former appointed lieutenant governor, and this generic Republican state legislator from a town of 500 nobody ever heard of. And for some reason, my campaign began by beating up on the lieutenant governor. And he responded by beating up on us. And guess what happened? They elected the generic state legislator nobody ever heard of. And that happens frequently. That's how Russ Feingold got in the U.S. Senate.
I would question your last comment. Max Cleland is an example where negative and untrue ads by his opponent knocked him out as the senator from Georgia.
I'm not saying for a minute that negative ads can't be effective. What I'm saying is that a campaign that goes unremittingly negative and never speaks about the vision that the other candidate has for the future is probably going to lose.
Getting back to the issue of money in politics, recently in Wisconsin there was a recall election for Governor Walker, and it was really essentially a state issue that he wanted to bust the teachers' unions plus some other issues. But in any case, considering it as the business of the people of Wisconsin, there were large amounts of money that came in from unions and large amounts of money that came in from Republicans, and he ended up winning. Now, it's my view that in politics, if you have an election, you should only be able to raise money from that particular region. In other words, money from Wisconsin should have settled that issue and not money from outside. we're old enough in this room to remember sound trucks. And for instance, if a candidate is having a speech and somebody drives by with a sound truck and drowns out what he's saying, that to me is unethical. And to me, money from outside in politics is the same as driving a sound truck past a guy giving a speech.
I'm a resident of Virginia. And if residents of other states are not allowed to vote on issues involving me, then I would be happy to say that they shouldn't be allowed to participate in Virginia elections, and I shouldn't be allowed to participate in their elections. But by God, if they're going to vote against my interests and be effective, I'm going to raise money against them.
Other questions? I want to ask one more. Terry, you're a lawyer.
I repented.
You were once. And it comes back a little bit to Bob's question and Citizens United. Corporations, as I recall, never appear in the Constitution, right? The concept.
I don't know the answer to that. I think not,
because, I think in the early days, corporations were for the public benefit. And they were created to encourage development and so forth and so on, primarily by reducing, limiting the liability of individuals that supported them. So, and I understand that, and that was a good thing. But since they're really not something that was in the basis of the Constitution, as I believe, why should you seem to be saying that they should have the same freedom of speech rights as an entity, a group of people that are not for profit, that are assembled together just because they have a common interest? You mentioned NAACP, but we could name all sorts of other organizations. Why isn't it reasonable to make that distinction?
Bob, I didn't know you were an originalist.
I didn't know either, but...
It's not me who is saying that corporations should have these rights. It's some people with actual authority, Supreme Court justices.
But as a lawyer, what do you think about that?
Well, I think that every organization around, for example, corporations, should have the right to due process of law, should have the right to petition for the redress of grievances, should have the right to publish newspapers, and that's free speech.
All right. You're decisive about that. Any other questions? All right. I see no hands, so let's thank Terry again for a nice talk. Thank you.
In the Charlottesville Podcasting Network, I'm Dan Gould.